crime story. Hey there, and welcome to episode 15 of Tell Me a True Crime Story. I'm your host, Holly. Thank you guys so much for being here. I hope that you and your family are happy, healthy, and safe. You know, I say that in every podcast. It's become like a little slogan, but I'm going to change it up a little bit, and I'm going to say, I hope that you and your family are happy, healthy, and together forever. Let me tell you the origin of that saying in my life. I'm better now for the most part, but for 22 plus years, I suffered in silence with depression and anxiety. I hid it from everyone. I prayed desperately for God to make me better, to take away the intrusive, repetitive, racing thoughts. And so many days and so many hours were filled with those thoughts that those thoughts just crowded out almost any normal thought. So much so that it was hard for me to even find the words to say anything else in my prayers except for, please, God, help me, please. And please, just let me and my family be happy, healthy, and together forever. I'm so grateful that these days people have started to talk about mental illness so that others don't have to suffer in silence like I did. I thought I was such a freak. I just knew that no one else was going through what I was going through. And it's truly a miracle that I didn't end up strung out on alcohol or drugs. I had my kids at a young age, and being busy taking care of them is probably the main thing that saved me from a lifetime of addiction. If you haven't ever had any problems with mental illness, then I'm sorry for blabbing about it. Before I developed depression and anxiety, others in my family had it, and I just couldn't understand it. I was thinking, you know, just get over it, suck it up. Then some years later, when I became afflicted with it, I knew just how wrong and ignorant I had been. I don't ever open up about myself on this podcast, but I just wanted to share with you guys where my little saying came from. And any of you that are listening that have mental illness or experience even bouts of depression and anxiety from time to time, know that you are not alone. And please, please know that there is life-changing and life-saving help out there. And please contact me by email if you need to. My email is hollystellmepodcast@gmail.com. And sorry for the chit-chat for those of you who absolutely despise it, but that was just a little tidbit that I felt like it was important to say, because if you're going through something, it really helps just to know that, you know, someone else is going through it or has gone through it, and they came out on the other end okay for the most part. So I truly love you guys, and big, big hugs to all of you, especially if you're sad, suffering, depressed. I wish I could give you a big hug. Thanks for being here and giving me some of your time and spending this time with me. So today I'm going to tell you about heinous murders committed by women who have been condemned to die by the state in which they committed their crime. Please follow the podcast and tell your family and friends about it. Also follow the podcast on social media. Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok are at Tell Me a True Crime Story, and Twitter is at Tell Me a TCS Pod. Not super, on social media a ton as far as the podcast goes, but I'm trying to get better at it and post more. I'm just so, so busy, and I wish I could devote more time to this podcast, but like I said, I'm still going to keep going. It may not be super consistent, but I'm still going to keep posting. I'm not going anywhere. So those of you that do listen every time I put out an episode, I really thank you a ton. So now let me tell you a true crime story. In 1608, the first recorded execution took place in the new colonies in North America. There are currently 27 states that have the death penalty in the United States, plus the federal government and the U.S. military. They have the death penalty as well. And there are 23 non-death penalty states, plus the District of Columbia. As of 2022 in the U.S., there are a little over 2,400 inmates on condemned row, or as it's most commonly known, death row. Women make up only about 2% of inmates condemned to die by the criminal justice system in the U.S., and here are a few of their stories. First, we're going to discuss the murders of two young girls committed by Janine Snyder and Michael Thornton in California. Michael Forrest Thornton was born in 1955 into an average middle-class family. He served in the United States Air Force. He got married and had a son in the 70s. Then his wife accused him of molesting a 6-year-old girl and divorced him. He eventually remarried a woman named Pamela, and they had a daughter together. They were living in Rialto, California, where his wife had family. In 1986, Michael Thornton opened his first of several hair salons, which made him a lot of money. He became a millionaire, and he had a vacation home, a boat, cars, and he took many vacations. In 1996, his 16-year-old daughter asked if her 14-year-old friend, Janine Marie Snyder, could come stay with them. Janine Snyder was a very troubled teenager who didn't do well in school, and she even used meth. Janine Snyder's mom was an IV drug user and addicted to meth. Reportedly, her mom's boyfriend had sex with 14-year-old Janine Snyder, so her mom kicked her out. As soon as Janine Snyder moved in with Michael Thornton and his family, Michael Thornton began grooming her to help him in fulfilling his sadistic sexual fantasies. He became obsessed with Janine Snyder. He even gave her meth. Soon after Janine Snyder moved in with Michael Thornton and his family in 1996, Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder lured 14-year-old Jessie K. Peters away from her home in Glendora, California. They took her to Michael Thornton's home in Lake Arrowhead, California, where she was handcuffed to the bed and raped by Michael Thornton as Janine Snyder watched. Then Jessie was placed in a bathtub half full of water. Without warning, Michael Thornton came in and held her head under the water until she died. Next, they dismembered Jessie's body and put her body parts into two igloo containers. They took those containers out in his boat off of Dana Point, California, and dumped Jessie's body parts overboard into the Pacific Ocean. Jessie's mom, Cheryl Peters, reported Jessie missing. She told police Jessie didn't take any personal belongings with her, but law enforcement officials still suspected that she was a runaway. Unbeknownst to Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder, Michael Thornton's wife, Pamela, had overheard her husband and young Janine Snyder discussing the murder of Jessie, the dismemberment of her body, and the dumping of her body parts into the ocean. However, Pamela stayed silent and did not tell anyone what she'd overheard for years. Eventually, she revealed, you know, her secret to her daughter, and her daughter went to the police. So Michael Thornton was abusive to his wife and his kids, and when his own teenage daughter and Janine Snyder bickered or didn't get along, he would kick out his daughter out of the house, and she'd go stay at her boyfriend's. His wife, Pamela, ended up leaving him after he beat her severely and left her with a black eye. After Michael Thornton's wife left him, he and Janine Snyder lived alone together. They traveled around a lot, scoping out teen girls. Janine Snyder was used as the bait to chat up the young girls and gain their trust. About 4 years after Jesse's disappearance, a young girl named Isabel and her mom went to police and reported that she'd been held captive by an older man and his younger girlfriend. She said when she'd run away from home, her boyfriend took her to a house in Rialto, California, and that couple there invited her to stay with them. They kept her there, and she wasn't allowed to leave. They made her into their sex slave. They kept her drugged up on cocaine, pot, and meth, which they forced her to take. She was threatened, beaten, and raped. Several times she attempted to escape, but she was caught each time. When she got so strung out on meth that her health had deteriorated and she was knocking on death's door, they let her go then. And that's when she went to the cops. Police arrested Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder and searched their home. They told the police that that girl was not beaten, sexually abused, or held captive. Citing a lack of evidence, the DA chose not to press charges, and Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder were released. The next year, in a Las Vegas, Nevada neighborhood, 16-year-old Michelle Curran was reluctantly walking to school when she was kidnapped by Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder. Michelle didn't want to go to school that day, and she was mad that she was made to go. Her mom reported her missing, and police dubbed her as a runaway. Her mom did not think that her daughter Michelle had run away. A couple of weeks later, in Rubidoux, California, a ranch owner heard a muffled gunshot coming from a horse tack room on her ranch. When she went to investigate, a young woman appeared from the tack room and told the woman that she had permission to be there from the ranch owner. The woman knew that was a lie because she was the ranch owner, and she'd never seen this girl before. But the woman played along, and she said, okay, and went back to her house and called 911. Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder took off. Police responded and caught Michael Thornton as he was fleeing the ranch. Janine Snyder managed to flag down a car and ask for a ride. The man in the car was a park ranger, and he took her to his ranger station. Janine Snyder was acting crazy, and she was hysterical, and employees at the ranger station called the police. She and Michael Thornton were both arrested for trespassing and burglary. When police searched their SUV, they found sex toys, duct tape, zip ties, ball gags, a list of schools, photos of teen girls being sexually assaulted, and a wallet containing Michelle Curran's ID. Police quickly learned that Michelle Curran was a missing teen out of Las Vegas. Back at the ranch in the tack room, police found a large amount of blood on the floor. Horse reins and horse lead ropes were out of place, and there were cable ties there. However, there was no body. 5 days later, the ranch owner went to clean out a horse trailer on her property and found the naked, beaten, and bruised dead body of a girl there. She'd been murdered with one shot to the forehead. Fingerprints confirmed that the girl was 16-year-old Michelle Curran that was missing from Las Vegas, a four-hour drive away. Now police added first-degree murder, rape, and torture charges to Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder's existing charges of trespassing and burglary. On April 4, 2001, Janine Snyder had lured Michelle Curran to Michael Thornton's SUV as she walked to school. Michelle was leery at first, but got into their vehicle. After she was in there, she got spooked and wanted to get out, but Michael Thornton pulled a gun on her. For the next 2 weeks, they sexually assaulted Michelle and gave her drugs as they drove around Arizona, Nevada, and California. They'd chosen to sexually assault Michelle on that ranch in Rubidoux because they'd wanted to use the horse reins and leads as restraints. In September of 2006, Michael Thornton and Janine Snyder were convicted and sentenced to death for the murder, rape, and torture of Michelle Curran by separate juries. They were not prosecuted for the death of Jesse Peters, but Jesse's mom, Cheryl, said she wants to be there when they're executed by the state of California. Michael Thornton is now 67 years old and is inmate number F41306. He sits on death row at San Quentin State Prison in San Quentin, California. Jeanine Snyder is now 43 years old and is inmate number X20232. She sits on death row at Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, California. Jessie K. Peters was an adorable blonde and wore braces when she was kidnapped. She had been raised by her aunts in South Bay, California, and had attended Hermosa Valley School. At the age of 12, she moved in with her mom, and her relatives described her as a kind and religious teenager. I couldn't really find anything about Michelle Leanne Curran in life. I can tell you that she was a beautiful girl, and she was born in August of 1984. Next, we're going to discuss Kathy Saragnana and what she did to end up on California's death row. In late December of 2005, Kathy Lynn Saragnana and her husband Raul Ricardo Saragnana were arrested in connection with the death of their 11-year-old nephew, Ricky Morales. Prosecutors in Riverside County, California, charged Kathy and Raul Saragnana with murder and child endangerment with a special circumstance of inflicting torture. On October 8, 2005, Kathy Saragnana had reported her other nephew, Ricky's older brother, 13-year-old Conrad Morales, as a runaway to the Lewis County, Washington Sheriff's Department. At the time Conrad went, air quotes, missing, Kathy Saragnana, her husband Raul Saragnana, their own two kids, and their nephews were living in a trailer park in Randall, Washington. The two boys were living with the Saragnanas because their mom, Raul Saragnana's sister Rosa, was doing time on felony charges in California. So a couple of days later, after Kathy Saragnana reported Conrad Morales missing, the Saragnanas picked up and moved to Corona, California with their kids and their nephew, Conrad's brother, Ricky. So this is the story of what happened to brothers Conrad and Ricky Morales. And yes, you heard me right. I just wanted to point that out, that on October 8th, 2005, Kathy Saragnana reported her other nephew, who was Ricky's older brother, missing. Then a couple of days later, while he's missing, they pick up and they move from Washington to California. So I just wanted to make sure you guys got that. Prior to Ricky's murder in December of 2005, a 17-year-old neighbor of the Saragnanas named Jessica had noticed Ricky with a black eye and bruises. Kathy Lynn Saragnana told her that he'd gotten into a fight at school. Then Jessica ran into Ricky again at a store, and this time his face had more severe bruises than before. Jessica's family offered to take Ricky in, but his aunt Kathy Saragnana declined their offer. When this case went to trial, the horrific details of the abuse suffered by Ricky were revealed. Police discovered Ricky dead in a closet the day after Christmas in 2005. He'd been beaten and left to die in that closet while the Saragnanas entertained their Christmas dinner guest. According to the prosecution, on Christmas Day, Ricky couldn't keep his food down and threw up. His aunt became insulted that Ricky had thrown up the meal she'd made for the family. Ricky was made to clean up his throw-up in the bathroom. When his uncle felt he wasn't cleaning it up quickly enough, he kicked Ricky several times. Ricky was then thrown in a bedroom closet. When he tried to open the closet door, his uncle stomped him several times. He was left there and died in that closet. The Saragnanas ended up calling 911 hours later when they discovered he'd died. When police showed up, Ricky's body was still in the closet covered with a towel. The walls and ceiling in the bathroom were spattered with blood. Raul Saragnana admitted to kicking and stomping Ricky in his confession to police. He also admitted to slamming Ricky's head into a wall. An autopsy on Ricky's thin body showed multiple external traumatic injuries. It also indicated that he'd been burned with cigarettes on his body, including on his genitals. The cigarette burns were weeks, if not months, old. Ricky's scrotal sac was severely damaged and his scrotum was damaged with a penetrating laceration. Scars on his body were consistent with Ricky having been whipped with an electrical cord. There were multiple scars on Ricky's scalp, mostly in the back center of his head. It turns out Ricky had been throwing up because he had massive internal injuries from ongoing abuse and couldn't keep any food down. Ricky's older brother, Conrad, who had gone quote-unquote missing in October when they lived in Washington State, was found dead too. His body was encased in a trash can that was filled with concrete at the Serranianas Corona, California home. An X-ray of the trash can showed the outline of his body in there. Investigators surmised that he'd been killed in Washington in August, and his body was transported with them when they moved to California in October. Prosecutors argued that Kathy Serranianas was complicit in the death of her nephew, Ricky. They said the investigation into Ricky's murder revealed that she played an active role in her husband's violent, prolonged, and ongoing abuse of their nephews. Prosecutors also said that the abuse of the brothers had begun over a year earlier when the boys first arrived to live with the Serranianas at their mobile home in Washington in late 2004. The Serranianas were tried together, but they each had separate juries. They were both found guilty of first-degree murder of Ricky Morales. Both juries recommended Raul and Kathy Serranianas be put to death by the state of California. The judge could have sentenced them to life instead, but the judge followed the jurors' recommendations and sentenced them both to death. After a defendant is sentenced to death in some death penalty states, an appeal to the state's highest court is mandatory. In other death penalty states, an appeal is optional. According to California's Office of the Attorney General, quote, a defendant who is sentenced to death is entitled to an automatic, non-waivable, direct appeal to the California Supreme Court. The California Supreme Court must find at least one new attorney, but usually two, for the defendant. End quote. Officials in Lewis County, Washington, where Ricky's older brother Conrad Morales was killed, have chosen not to prosecute the Serranianas because they have already received death sentences in California. In remembrance of the victims, I wanted to let you know that Ricky Carlos Morales had a wide grin and dimples. He was said to have been the family clown. He always made everyone laugh. He was a people pleaser and was very affectionate. Conrad Anthony Morales was athletic and had deep brown eyes. He was popular in his class. He loved to play outside and loved birds and bird watching. He was a devoted brother who looked out for his younger brother. Now we're fast forwarding to the year 2010 to Ensley, Florida, which is a suburb of Pensacola near the Alabama border. The population in Ensley, Florida in 2010 was a little over 20,000 people, so considered a small city. When I cover these cases, I find myself wishing I could go back in time and warn the victim. Like when you're watching a scary movie and you know what's going to happen and you want to scream at the TV, turn around, he's right behind you, or watch out, or don't go in there. Like, I wish I could go back to 2010 and tell Adriana Zimmerman, no, do not go there. It's a trick. They are not your friends. Don't trust them. 39-year-old Tina Brown and her 16-year-old daughter, Brittany Miller, lived on lot number 3 in Cypress Trail Mobile Home Park, located at 904 Detroit Boulevard. 27-year-old Heather Lee lived in Cypress Trail Mobile Home Park 2 in a trailer on lot number 1. Adriana Zimmerman lived there too, in between Tina Brown and her daughter, Brittany Miller, and Heather Lee. And Adriana Zimmerman lived in on lot number 2. So Adriana was 19 years old and she had 2 kids. All of these young women were neighbors and they were all friends with one another. Heather Lee and Adriana Zimmerman were said to have been close friends. At some point, problems started amongst Tina Brown, her daughter Brittany Miller, and Audriana Zimmerman. Tina Brown had accused Audriana of slashing her tires. Audriana had accused Tina Brown of breaking a window in her car, having her boyfriend arrested, and reporting her to the Florida Department of Children and Families. One time, Brittany Miller tried to hit Audriana because she'd recently discovered that Audriana was sleeping with her boyfriend. Audriana tried to stop Brittany Miller's attack by using a stun gun on her. Heather Lee told Brittany Miller's mom, Tina Brown, that Audriana had used a stun gun on her daughter, so she said she was going to get her. Several days later, on March 24th, 2010, Tina Brown had been acting friendly toward Audriana all day, and she invited Audriana over to her house. Audriana went to Tina Brown's trailer around 9 p.m. After Audriana was there for about 5 minutes, Tina Brown started screaming at her. She came up behind Audriana, shocked her several times with a stun gun, and struck her. Audriana lost muscular control from the stun gun and fell to the ground. She was screaming and crying for help, and Tina Brown continued to shock her, torturing her with the stun gun. Tina Brown dragged Audriana across the trailer into the bathroom. Audriana was struck in the face and a sock was stuffed into her mouth. She was forced outside and into the trunk of Tina Brown's vehicle. Tina Brown, her daughter Brittany Miller, and Heather Lee took Audriana about a mile and a half away from the trailer park to a clearing in the woods. Tina Brown got out and pulled Audriana out of the trunk. Audriana tried to run away, but she tripped and fell down and was caught by Tina Brown and her daughter Brittany Miller. They both began to attack Audriana. Tina Brown was using the stun gun on her, and Brittany Miller was beating her with a crowbar. Then they switched weapons and continued to shock her with the stun gun and beat her with the crowbar. At some point, Brittany Miller dropped the crowbar and punched Audriana repeatedly. Tina Brown went back to her car and got a can of gasoline. She went to Audriana, who was conscious but badly beaten and lying face down, and poured gasoline onto her. She lit Audriana on fire and stood there and watched as Audriana screamed in agony. Heather Lee testified that Brittany Miller jumped up and down and yelled, "Burn, bitch, burn!" After a few minutes, the three women returned to Tina Brown's car and drove away. On the way home, Brittany Miller realized that she'd left her shoes and the stun gun at the scene of the attack, but her mom, Tina Brown, would not turn around to go get them. A little while later, just off of Lepley Road, about a third of a mile from where the attack on Audriana happened, a man named Terrence Hendrick heard a faint female voice asking for help, but he couldn't see anyone. That is, until he saw Audriana walking out of the darkness toward his house. She asked him for help and sat on his front steps. He noticed she suffered a significant head injury. She didn't seem to have any clothes on, and she smelled strongly of gasoline. Her skin was black. His dad immediately called 911, and Terrence stayed with her until help arrived. When paramedics arrived at Terrence's house at 9:24 p.m., they found Audriana sitting on the front porch, rocking back and forth, moaning and holding her arms straight out. She had burns over most of her body, had severe head trauma, and her jaw appeared to be either broken or dislocated. Despite these horrific injuries, she was conscious and alert. She was pleading for help. She said she was going to pass out. She told him what had happened to her. She'd been dragged out of the house, tased, beaten in the head with a crowbar, and set on fire. She gave him the names of the women who did it to her and repeated their names several times. She said she, quote, thought they had made up, end quote. She asked an EMT to protect her kids and gave him her address. The EMT testified at trial that he could not initially tell if Audriana was wearing clothes or not. Her skin was falling off of her body. At that time, he believed she had burns over 90% of her body. He further testified that he generally placed sterile gauze and oxygen on burns, but he didn't have enough gauze to cover her entire body. When he tried to stabilize Adriana's neck, her skin was so charred, it was rubbing off onto his gloves. Susie Davis, a paramedic supervisor, started to treat Adriana in the ambulance. Susie Davis tried to intubate Adriana and give her morphine and a paralytic drug. However, she couldn't intubate Adriana. It was impossible to get a tube in her airway because it had become so swollen. Adriana kept asking Susie Davis if she was going to be okay. Adriana was transported to Sacred Heart Hospital in Pensacola, where she was stabilized. She was then transferred to the Burn Center at the University of South Alabama Hospital in Mobile, Alabama, about 60 miles away. Investigators located the area where Adriana had been attacked off of Ashland Avenue. They found a pair of white shoes, a bloody Talon stun gun, and a skirt. 40 feet away, they found a trail of bloody burnt tissue, a hair weave, a pool of blood, and a crowbar. Still further down the trail was more burned material and a burned bra. Mercifully, Adriana had been placed in a medically induced coma. Sadly, she died 16 days later on April 9th, 2010. Adriana had been burned over 60% of her body. An autopsy showed a laceration and bruises on her head. She had burns on her torso, legs, scalp, and upper back. The medical examiner testified that the cause of her death was multiple thermal injuries and the manner of death was homicide. And then I was left wondering, how do thermal burns kill you? Like, what actually happens to the body when you get burned so severely that it makes you succumb to your injuries and die? Well, I looked into it, and it's a lot to understand medically because the human body undergoes local and systematic pathophysiological responses to severe burn trauma. And pathophysiological just means the abnormal changes that happen in the body because of a particular condition or disease. From the moment you are burned, the human body starts to react wildly. It's very complex and there are many complications that can occur, but common complications are multiple organ failure due to the body's increased inflammatory response and sepsis, which is blood poisoning, and toxic shock syndrome can happen from burns becoming infected. DNA in blood found on the passenger headrest of Tina Brown's SUV matched the victim, Adriana. Tina Brown's DNA was found in a red stain on the handle of the stun gun. Brittany Miller's DNA was found on the white shoes at the area of the attack. Adriana's DNA was on both ends of the crowbar found near the scene of the attack. Heather Lee was initially charged with first-degree murder and was facing the death penalty. However, she pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in exchange for her testimony in court. She received a sentence of 25 years in prison and is serving her time as Florida Department of Corrections inmate number P46705 at Gadsden Correctional Facility in Quincy, Florida. Her current release date is May 15, 2032, at which time she will be 49 years old. Brittany Miller was a minor at the time of the murder, therefore she was exempt from receiving a death sentence. In 2013, she was sentenced to life in prison. According to an article by Kevin Robinson of the Pensacola News Journal, quote, after a Supreme Court ruling made it unconstitutional to give juveniles an automatic life sentence, Miller was granted a new sentencing hearing in 2017, end quote. The judge upheld her life sentence in 2017 at that new sentencing hearing. She is, however, entitled to a sentencing review in 15 years because of her juvenile status. Brittany Miller is serving her time as Florida Department of Corrections inmate number P48041 at the Lowell Annex in Ocala, Florida. Tina Brown was sentenced to death on September 28, 2012. She is Florida Department of Corrections inmate number 155-917 and sits on Florida's death row at the Lowell Annex in Ocala, Florida. I wish I could tell you more about the victim, Adriana, who she was in life, what she enjoyed, but I couldn't really find anything. I can tell you that she was born on Friday, April 13th, 1990. Her middle name was Redon, and she had two children. Adriana's biological mom's name was Misty Regino, and her mom passed away at the age of 51 in 2020, 10 years after her daughter. Adriana is buried at Olton Cemetery in Olton, Texas. Thank you for listening to this episode of Tell Me a True Crime Story. Please follow the podcast and tell your friends and family about it. And please share the podcast or share an episode that you loved. Follow on social media. Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok are at Tell Me a True Crime Story. And Twitter is at Tell Me a TCS Pod. Also, if you would, it would help me out so much. Please write a review for the podcast or rate it by giving it 5 stars. I would really, truly appreciate it. Thank you again for being here. And you know that I just appreciate each and every one of you so much for being here. Join me in the next episode, episode 16, when I'll tell you another true crime story. Big hugs to all of you. Bye-bye.